Bienvenue to Battle Royale, where we are passing judgment on all the kings and emperors of France from Clovis to Napoleon III.
Who will be... Oh my god, I just mental blanked on that thing.
Who'll be selected?
Who's selected? Yeah, I was like, who will be something cream? Okay, who'll be selected as the... Oh my god, I've still forgotten it. Why have I forgotten it? Creme de la creme, getting... and who'll be sent to the guillotine?
You're getting bloody senile hell. In your old age.
I know. I again. Same turn 27. Goes downhill.
All right, so...
Yeah. There's no, transition.
We are doing... we are doing part two of King Francis I, who we've been thoroughly enjoying so far, but it has been a week since we recorded, so this might be an extra chaotic Eliza recap that we have to do currently.
If I remember anything about the person.
So to refresh us a bit on just the basic gist of Francis's life, Eliza, would you like to...
Okay, so he was born, right? He existed.
Good place to start.
Yeah. He grew up kind of as, like, the heir apparent, but, like, wasn't, like you know, the official Dauphin. Then they're, like, didn't have the title, but, you know, name and all the title eventually.
It's called the heir presumptive when you can be replaced.
Okay.
Whereas heir apparent is you can't be replaced.
Was it his cousin? His uncle, second cousin, was it?
So Louis, he was his
first cousin once removed.
First cousin once removed. Yes, they were first cousins once removed. Also, Louis was his father-in-law.
Yeah.
Just to add a spanner in that.
Yeah, Claude was like a beautiful. That was who he married. Who's like a sweet little thing, but he just impregnated her like every year of her entire life, basically.
Yeah.
He and King Henry VIII, like, meh. But then when they met together, they were like, oh my god, we are besties. We have so much in common. Oh my god, we're just here for a good time. But then aside from that...
And they left again. They were like, meh.
Meh, yeah. So, like, when they're together, they're like instant besties. Second they're separated, they forget each other's good points and hate each other. But before that happened, literally, like, the second Francis came king, he's like, let's go to war! Let's go to Italy! And so hop, skip, and jump, he went to Italy, and it was very well done. Well, good at first. Good campaign.
Yeah, had a great battle.
Very successful.
Yeah,
he went back home and was like, I had a great time. And then... A few years later, things turned to shit, and he's like, okay, I better go back to Italy. But that wasn't such a success as the first time, because he got captured, and Charles of Spain was like, ha ha ha, I have got you prisoner, and I'm very dull and totally opposite you, so we're not going to get along, but I'm going to keep you moving around Spain so you get a free tour of Spain as my prisoner.
I'm now just imagining Francis in, like, a prison cell and Charles, like, reading him boring poetry or, like, sermons to, like, just bore him and to torture him.
Yeah, probably. No, but it wouldn't just be a prison. It'd be a prison with wheels so he can get around for his little tour, free tour of Spain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And then... Francis is like, oh my god, I'm dying of in here. But mother, do not give in. Because his mother was in charge back home. He's like, do not give in. I will not be made a fool, even though I'm already captured. Don't give in anything. But mum's like, we need you. You're the bloody king. So I'm going to give in and send your children to be the hostages. And you'll come back. And we'll also give Spain a few little things. Okay, some land. And it'll be all
Burgundy.
Yeah, and it'll be all good.
All that wine. Ugh.
And so then he comes back. Does his wife die when he's in prison?
His wife does die when he's in prison. Yeah.
So he was a bit sad.
But then he comes back and he's like, screw you.
Yeah, but instead he married Charles's sister, Eleanor of Austria.
But before that, he starts a league, kicks up a fuss, and refuses to do... to follow through with the treaty to give Burgundy up.
Yeah, that just kind of fell apart because the Protestants are starting to make a move and everyone's like,
yeah, so Charles has like to that. Compromise.
Yeah, and then eventually, like, they get the prince and the duke back and it's like, okay, whatever. Yeah. And then everyone else starts dying around him.
And everyone starts dying, pretty much. And it just kind of goes back and forth of, like, peace, war, and the Pope is like, please just stop.
Get it together.
We have all these Protestants. We have these Ottomans. We need to, you know.
You know. unite.
Catholics need to be together. But it's just
Catholics
not
unite.
Right,
and everyone's like, no.
And we got Henry VIII. This is his whole thing happening.
Yeah.
But we didn't look at
that. Yeah. And then eventually he dies.
And then he dies. Yeah. So yeah, that's pretty much the basic gist. We will be getting into certain aspects of his reign and further details that we kind of skipped over. But I will remind you of events if they come up, if they become relevant when we start rating Francis. So this episode, we're rating Francis. So we're going to get into Enchanté, first of all, to look at his kingly image and his legacy.
Enchanté.
But before I send you portraits of him, Eliza, okay, I want to tell you the physical description of him, and then we can see like if the portraits like measure up to that.
Okay.
The main physical description that's usually quoted about Francis is from a Venetian diplomat, Antonio de Beatis, who you get a lot of stuff from ambassadors writing about these kings with like brutal honesty, because they're the ones that can kind of be honest.
Yeah, they're the ones who have to send it back to their master, lord, whatever, leader.
Whereas the courtiers, you can't really trust what they say as much, because it's like they're kind of just flattering the king.
Yeah.
And this is in 1517. So this is like just when he's become king, when he's like a young man.
Yeah.
He's just had his great war.
Okay.
So is, you know, the height of his youth, I suppose.
Yes,
he says that Francis is, quote, very tall, well-featured, and has a pleasant disposition, cheerful and most engaging, though he has a large nose, and in the opinion of many, his legs are too thin for so big a body. And then a couple of years later, at the Field of Cloth of Gold, a Welsh soldier says he has, quote, muscular buttocks and thighs, but agrees that he has thin and bandy legs. He also says he has an agreeable voice and a lively conversation, married by the habit of continually rolling his eyes upwards. So he's got a bit of assassin attitude as well.
I don't know why. I'm just in my head, I'm thinking of my year 12 religion teacher, because he did not seem like a religion teacher. He was young and stuff and he had a bubble butt.
Right.
Can you think of that?
I'm thinking of, what's his name? Johnny Bravo. The cartoon.
He's
got the massive body and the tiny legs.
Yeah.
Or like something out of the Flintstones. I don't know. He's a Hanna-Barbera character, basically. As we've learned, Francis had this real love for ostentatious extravagance.
And
his 21st century biographer, Leonie Frieda, compares him to one of those colourful exotic birds, always showing off his plumage with, quote, rich cloaks of ermine trimmed with gold and lined with heron's feathers, fastened with gold buckles and brooches, with a dazzling array of pearls and diamonds. His writing desk was set in gold. He carried mirrors and looking glasses made of crystal and studded with emeralds, and the books in his library were clasped with silver and bound in velvet.
Wow.
So this is an unprecedented level of fashion and splendor happening at Francis's court.
So him and the Sun King would have got along.
Which is perhaps making up for certain other failings in Francis's personality and Francis's leadership. But we will get to those when we focus on the other aspects of his reign. But yeah, now I will show you the images. We have reached a period where there are going to be just dozens of depictions of the king from like not only their own time but also like hundreds of years after, so I'm going to be increasingly selective about the ones that I'm gonna like show everyone. I'll probably just stick to like the most famous images, like the most iconic images of the person. And I think from this point forward we should think less about how many images they have and more like the quality of these images, or like you know, literally just how good they look, or like how fabulous they are.
Would I want to date them?
Yeah, because every king is just going to have a lot of images, because we're now in peak, you know, portraiture period. Also, as ever, these images will all be available on our WordPress, so if at any point you get confused, just go to the WordPress. The link will be on the episode. So, the earliest portrait of Francis, which is by Jean Clouet, the court painter that his mother, Louise of Savoy, brought in. This is Francis at the very beginning of his reign, so he's about 21 in this portrait.
Oh, here's a little bit of hair.
Yeah, they're really into the not like full beards but like chin fluff in this time, but he will get a beard in the next in the next portrait.
Yeah, he really does have big shoulders.
Yes, he's got massive shoulders. And he was very He was very proud of his broad shoulders. He would make them even broader by, you know, the clothing he'd wear. We're in that period of, like, if you imagine that portrait of Henry VIII that everyone knows.
Oh, yep, the puff puff.
Portrait with the huge puffing sleeves. Yeah, that's where nice. We are. Cod pieces, all of it. Like, all of that extravagance.
And his funny little hat that looks like it got run over by a carriage.
Yes, he's got the crumpled sort of shootery hat.
Literally, it got run over by a carriage and he was like, oh, it's good enough. Stick it back on.
Yeah, but then here's the second portrait and we see him getting more extravagant. And this is by the same painter, by the way, Jean Clouet, but it's just 10 years later, basically.
Yeah, and those puff sleeves.
Those humongous sleeves. And this will be the episode image, the second one, because it is my favorite portrait of
Yeah,
Francis.
I prefer. It is good. It's got that gold. It's got that bedazzled hat with the fur or the feather trim, whatever it is.
Mm. And his facial expression is like, yeah.
It's like, yeah, I know I'm good. Yeah.
I know I'm sexy.
I'm looking fine.
But yeah, the detail on this jacket. Yeah,
in his hands.
Amazing.
I love how you like detail on the jacket. I'm like, oh, look at his hands. The detail on the hands.
Oh, his hands lovely as well.
Yeah, they are very good hands.
But also, this is the first portrait we have where we have slashing, which is one of my favorite things in Renaissance fashion, is the slashing.
Yeah, that is nice.
It comes from, I believe, Swiss soldiers.
Yeah.
There's like a legend that their like sleeves got slashed and like they pulled out bits of the linen shirt underneath to like show that they'd like been in battle or whatever. And then this becomes a thing in fashion throughout Europe where it's to show just how much lovely white, beautiful linen cloth you have underneath your already extravagant flowing jacket. But yeah, those bloody sleeves. Look at the volume. Look at the material. Yeah,
they're amazing. I like the necklace and how there's a sword hinting at his military. You notice they've done the shadow. I don't know if it's a stain or if the painter's actually done the shadow of the king.
Yes, I actually haven't noticed that. But yeah, if you look very closely on the right-hand side.
Yeah, you don't see that. It's very rare to see a shadow.
And this is the same painter, by the way, the two paintings. So you can see he's honing his craft.
I like that.
Yeah. Jean Clouet's son, Francois Clouet, is actually my favorite court painter in French history. His portraits are really good, and we'll be getting to those in like Catherine de Medici's time. So, yeah, we'll get to that. But around the same time this was painted in 1530, the great Venetian painter Titian, who I don't know if you've heard of Titian, he's
heard the name, but
a big name. He produced this painting showing Francis and the Ottoman Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent hanging out together. Although they never actually hung out to commemorate their historical alliance. So Titian, what he did is he went to Suleiman, he painted Suleiman, and then he went to Francis, painted Francis, and then just kind of put them in the same portrait.
Oh my God, I love his hats.
Suleiman's turban. Suleiman's giant onion turban.
I like it.
It looks like a really... It looks like, I was about to say, it looks like a really tasty... It looks like one of those pork buns.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
But that profile is very impressive for Suleiman.
That is. It's amazing he went all the way, though. Like, because, you know, they don't usually...
Yeah. Artists. Because Suleiman has a more sort of small, spindly kind of frame, whereas Francis is this big beefy boy.
Yeah. But they both have similar colored clothing, showing, like, the connection almost between
them. Yeah, the solidarity between them.
Yeah.
I believe this portrait would have been much brighter originally. Like, it's kind of faded, but...
As they do.
But, yeah, you get the idea. So this is a very famous depiction of Francis and Suleiman as well. And then we get a portrait of Francis slightly later in life, in his 40s, by a Dutch painter called Joost van Cleve. And this is... all the ones I've shown so far have been in the Louvre, I believe. Oh, no, wait. The first one was in the Musée Condé. The second one's in the Louvre. Third one, I'm not sure, but this one is in the Philadelphia Art Museum, so it's actually in America. It was painted by a Dutch painter.
Well, he's got his glove off. Better slap a person for a duel.
It shows that, like, he always just come in from riding, and he takes his gloves off when he comes inside, and he's got a sword by his side as well. I love the detail on his hat. On his like vest thing.
That is nice detail.
Lots of little ribbons and things. and his fur coming off his shoulders. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Still with the big sleeves. And the feathery hat is very... The hats are getting better. Mm-hmm. The hats are improving.
Yeah. Yeah, it's less crumpled. It's more like at the horse races hat.
Yeah. But yeah, once again, I mean, this is a through line with all these portraits is just the nose, the impressive
nose. And the facial hair.
Yeah. I think this may even be where French people get the stereotype of their noses. So there's also many depictions from the time of the Field of Cloth of Gold. The most famous is a painting from 1545, painted 15 years later, so towards the end of Francis and Henry VIII's life. And it's housed in Hampton Court Palace in England.
There's a bloody dragon!
Yeah, there's a dragon in the sky of this one, which is probably the first thing you notice. Automatically gives you a clue that, you know, this is very much a mythologizing painting of the event. But it's nice to have a dragon. So I'll read you the description, which is from the Royal Collection Trust.
Yeah.
The meeting between Henry VIII and Francis I, known as the Field of Cloth of Gold, took place between the 7th to 24th of June 1520 in a valley subsequently called the Val d'Or, the Valley of Gold. It was a spectacle of the greatest magnificence, and the several artists responsible for this painting have made a fairly accurate visual summary of the various festivities that took place during the meeting of the two kings. English party was based in the town of Guisnes, seen in the left half of the painting. The king entered the town on the 5th of June, accompanied by Catherine of Aragon, who appears not to be represented in the procession. Oh, poor Catherine. Well, this was painted after, you know...
After her, yeah.
The drama. Yeah, yeah. Several members of the king's suite on horseback can be identified. Sir Thomas Wriothesley. Just lists a bunch of people then. Cardinal Wolsey is alongside the king, with his crossbearer riding ahead. The right-hand foreground is dominated by a palace, specially erected for the occasion by 6,000 men from England and Flanders, sent ahead of the royal party. The palace was set on brickwork foundations, but the walls and roof were made of canvas, painted to look like a solid structure. The framework was of timber, specifically imported from the Netherlands, the windows of real glass, and the facade was adorned with sculpture. Two fountains in front of the palace provided wine and beer for the people's consumption, the overindulgence of which leads some of the figures in the painting being sick or engaging in brawling. Behind the temporary palace are the king's golden dining tent and the ovens and tents in which the king's meals were prepared. The formal meeting between Henry VIII and Francis I takes place in the rich tent at the center background.
Yeah.
To the right is the tournament field with the two kings and their queens watching the events from the side. In the corner of the field stands the Tree of Honor. On the top left of the painting is the dragon, or salamander, firework, which was released on the 23rd of June. Also, it's meant to be like a firework that was made to look like a dragon or a salamander, which is Francis' symbol. The tents used by lesser members of the royal family, royal suite, stretch into the background. With Calais and Ardre, where the seemingly much smaller French party were based, seen in the distance. So this depiction is obviously from the English end of things. So it does downplay the extravagance of Francis's, you know, contribution to the Field of Gold.
Yeah.
But we know that Francis brought just as many people and just as many rich adornments.
Yes.
So it can be seen as a joint effort between him and Henry. Mm. But yeah, definitely the most extravagant part of his legacy.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of symbolism for Francis, moving on to that, we've got his salamander badge, which is the most famous sort of emblem of his reign. You can see this, the fiery salamander all over the palaces of Francis. And his motto is Nutrisco et Extinguo, which means nourish and extinguish, implying like, you know, nourish goodness, extinguish badness kind of thing.
Nice.
Because the salamander is supposed to be this indestructible representation of Francis and his virtues that are impervious to the flames. We've also got some epithets, a few of them.
Yes.
Francis is often called Le Roi Chevalier, the Night King.
Yes.
Not to be confused with the one from Game of Thrones. Also, Le Roi Guerrier, the Warrior King. So he's very much a war-based sort of legacy. He's also called, more on the appearance side of things, the Roi du Grand Nez, King Big Nose, which is perhaps my favorite epithet. And also on the more, you know, cultural side of things, he's known as the father of letters for his patronage of the arts and literature.
That's a nice one.
So there's a well-rounded span.
Yeah, he's got a whole range.
Another epithet which was not used at the time, but which has been used by modern historians, is the Renaissance king. This is often what he's referred to as. And this is linked to both Francis's lifestyle as a sort of Renaissance man and his cultural policy, which was a lot more expansive than his predecessors.
Mm.
He didn't like oppose the Renaissance, his predecessors.
They didn't embrace fully.
And they encouraged, you know, innovations like the printing press. But yeah, they were still fundamentally kind of medieval sort of rulers. In Francis, we kind of for the first time have a ruler that we can call a Renaissance man who like fully engaged with the intellectuals of the humanist movement. He saw himself as a rational king who embraced modern ideas and who didn't solely let like religious zealotry kind of lead the way. for example, he's not obsessed with crusades, which is kind of refreshing. In fact, he's making friends with Muslims. Although he was still just as uber religious as many other kings have been. Since, you know, kings only rule by the grace of God. And he attended mass every day. He at least appearance-wise, kept up that. He also dabbled in the occult as well. He believed in magic, which most people did at this time. He hired magicians and mystics as well as scholars and philosophers. So like science, religion, magic, they're all kind of bound up together in the Renaissance. And that's why being a Renaissance man today kind of refers to someone with a broad, expansive education who kind of dabbles in lots of different things. Now, moving on to architecture. We've already talked about the field of cloth and gold and the makeshift structures there.
But where's the permanent?
But yes, now we get to the permanent stuff. So in Francis's reign, we start to see less and less Gothic stuff and more Italian influence coming in. More inspired by the kind of classical Romanesque architecture that we've seen happening in Florence.
Nice.
So in this style, Francis renovated the Louvre and Fontainebleau, giving the king more stylish residences in and around Paris. Meanwhile, in the Loire Valley, he built an entirely new chateau at Chambord, which took his entire reign to complete. it's perhaps the most famous physical remnant of his legacy.
Did he get to experience it?
He did a bit, yeah, but it wasn't entirely completed until like the very, very end of his reign. But I've experienced it because I've been to Chambord, and it was interesting. It was very much, it was definitely the most touristy chateau that I went to last time I went to France. I went to a few others belonging to Catherine de Medici, and they were a lot more
quieter.
I don't know, nice. I would say nicely curated. Chambord is a bit kind of overly touristy, I think. But it's very different to the chateaus that we're going to see with Catherine de Medici and like Diane de Poitiers and like later rulers. It's more big and monumental and like, look at me.
Francis-y.
Yeah.
It's his personality in a castle form.
Yes. Although one fascinating part of the architecture is that Francis's bedchamber is identical to all of the other bedchambers. So all of his companions, all of his like friends would have similar quarters to him and similar like lifestyle as well. So he liked to feel like he was on equal footing with the men around him.
Yeah.
Which we'll get to a bit more in Voulez-Vous.
Yeah.
And also the palace is arranged around a giant double spiral staircase. So it's kind of got this symmetrical kind of like, it almost feels like as you're walking around, it almost feels like you're moving around a wheel. And the spiral staircase is said to have been inspired by the designs of Leonardo da Vinci, who died the same year that it started construction. Let's also not forget that Leonardo bequeathed to France in his brief time there the most famous image of all time, the Mona Lisa, as long as we're speaking about images. Not that Francis had much to do with the Mona Lisa, but you know, it did join the Louvre collection in his time. And we'll be getting into Leonardo's time in France in a Patreon episode at some point. But I think the fact that Francis brought Leonardo to France, you know, definitely helped his visual legacy in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that gives him points.
Although the story of Leonardo dying in Francis's arms is not true. Francis was absent at the time. So we got some later portrayals as well. A couple of the most famous ones are, we've got Alexandre Évariste Fragonard's painting of Francis at the Battle of Marignano. And this is kind of like a sort of glorious 19th century battle depiction, yeah, with Francis at the very center with his extravagant plumed helmet and his fine white horse.
Yes. Oh, that plumage. Well, I'm just looking at the person on the in the edge of the, and he's like pointing, he's like, why? Why?
The horrors of war. And then I also have this painting by Angler, a great neoclassical artist, of Francis at the deathbed of Leonardo, quote, receiving his last breath.
Oh my God. Okay. When I first saw that, I was like, what the F is wrong with the neck? The body's melting. And then I realized it was the beard.
Yeah, it does kind of look like
his face is melting.
Just kind of look like Leonardo is just melting. But this very famous painting of the great painter Leonardo supposedly dying in Francis' arms. This never happened. But it is a famous depiction.
Hmm.
So those are the portrayals of Francis and his legacy. What do we want to give him for Enchanté?
Yeah, I think he's good.
He's definitely one of the most famous kings of France.
Yeah, he's impressive. I like him. I like the depictions. I like how they've got the continuity. Because, like, you know, sometimes, like, with some of the kings they've had, like, each of their portraits are very vastly different. But for all these ones they've got, they've really kept the same features. Like,
he has very strong features, doesn't he? Yeah.
The facial hair, obviously the nose, but they've, like, kept it going. While some of them, I'm like, with some of the ones in the past, I'm like, were they reading the description about the same person?
He's just so distinctive. There's so much character in these portraits.
Yeah.
Whether it's kind of like the young, fresh, beardless one, or like the
he's a slight beard.
30s at the height of his power and everything, or you know the one that's a bit later. He's sort of in his twilight years. He's looking a bit more like kind of like tired. You can see the progression. It's really nice to have all these portraits to pick from.
And I like the depictions of various rulers too. That's cool.
Yeah, exactly.
Obviously above 5, easily. 9.
I was thinking it might even be a 10.
Yeah.
I mean, we gave Anne of Brittany a 10.
True. Yeah, he's pretty iconic. Like,
he's pretty iconic. Continuity. He kind of overshadows everyone else around this time.
Yeah. Like, the only reason why people even remember Henry VIII is because of all his wives.
Yeah,
that scandal.
And in a way, sort of Henry VIII was constantly trying to emulate Francis.
Yeah.
Like, if we look at Francis's fashion, we say, oh, it's kind of Henry VIII fashion. But really, it's the other way around. Henry VIII was trying to copy Francis. Because, you know, Francis where all the fashion comes from, basically.
Yeah.
So I think a 10 out of 10 is
yeah, warranted. Actually, I agree with you. 10 out of 10. Yeah.
I think I'm happy with this being his best round because we'll see future rounds. So. He may be letting us down a little bit in certain places. Okay. So, but yeah, in terms of kingly image, in terms of legacy, I think it's
yeah, I agree.
Francis.
Okay.
So moving on to En Garde.
En Garde.
Let's talk about his gaining power.
Yes.
We have credited Francis's mother, Louise, with kind of setting him up to be an effective ruler. But this wouldn't have meant much if Francis weren't formidable in his own right. You know, he was able to follow through. His most valuable asset was his good health and his relentless energy, which is thought to rival that of Charlemagne himself.
Mm.
Francis's court was constantly on the move, with one Venetian ambassador, different one to the one before, complaining that he never stayed in the same place for more than 2 weeks.
He's like, I'm tired of all this.
Francis was also an avid hunter, a sport that demands frequent traveling in search of fresh game. And once again, he was an avid lover of hunting dogs, as we've seen with lots of kings. He also enjoyed jousting and elaborate mock battles, as well as tennis, of course. None of these were as fatal to Francis as they have been and will continue to be for certain kings. He did have a number of close calls and suffered numerous accidents and injuries in his time. He fell off his horse a couple of times, hunting and jousting. Mm-hmm. once at a party, he set himself on fire, and he suffered some related head injuries as well.
Didn't stop him.
So he's it's all the greatest hits of like setting like king going on fire, king hitting his head, king falling off horses. He never died from these. But Francis's disregard for protocol and his personal safety led to a lot of courtiers calling him careless and reckless, even foolish. And a lot of the time, he was seen as kind of not holding himself with the dignity that a king should. So Francis's nomadic lifestyle meant he kept up with the demands of an increasingly large royal domain and a constant cycle of wars and peace treaties. Like many successful kings, Francis knew the value that the royal presence could have in the morale of the French troops or in like the negotiating power of a delegation. The big exception to this was in 1529 with the Treaty of Cambrai, the ladies' peace, which Francis refused to attend and which was told by his mother, Louise of Savoy.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, neither Francis nor the Emperor Charles could bring themselves to face each other. Speaking of Charles, so of all the challenges Francis faced in his life, Charles was the biggest. He was the biggest threat to his power. In fact, Charles and the fact that France was now surrounded on all its land borders by the one enemy was the root cause of most of his problems. Even when we see that like internal rebellion in France with Monty, the Duke of Bourbon, rebelling against Francis, he's very much bankrolled by Emperor Charles and ends up joining Charles when he gets exiled. So Charles is always behind everything that goes wrong in Francis's life. But while Charles's European territories far exceeded Francis, and that's not even including his new Spanish Empire in America, France was much more united and cohesive than Charles's disparate territories. For example, he struggled to gain acceptance among the nobles of Spain and Naples.
Oh, yeah.
He had to constantly make treacherous sea journeys between his different realms. And the Reformation in Switzerland, Central Germany, and the Netherlands, so like the rise of Protestantism in these regions, were an absolute nightmare for him.
Oh, yeah.
So even though Francis ultimately failed to maintain control of Milan, which was his big goal, and the Italian wars will continue for another 12 years after his death, I think it's kind of a win for Francis that he was able to maintain like the integrity and unity of France itself, despite this unprecedented external threat. Also, the Spanish Imperial Union didn't really last. A few years after France's death, unable to manage his vast territory, Emperor Charles ended up abdicating the throne of Spain to his son, Philip II, and abdicated Austria to his brother Ferdinand, who becomes the next emperor. So now the Habsburg family gets split into two branches, although they will continually intermarry to the extent that they breed themselves out of existence, which we know is the most it's famous thing about the Habsburgs.
The hills are alive with the sound of...
He's your cousin. Yeah, but he's my first cousin. Right. So you have your cousins, and then you have your first cousins, and then you have your second cousin.
No.
Now, on the military front, we've got the standard French army excelling in cavalry, now with the addition of cannons, which are the best in Europe, rivaled only by the artillery of the Ottomans. We also see the introduction of arquebusiers, handgunners, in Francis's reign, which develop into musketeers by the end of the 16th century.
Cool.
But France lacked effective infantry, which made up the vast majority of the army. Mostly this infantry was just like drawn from the different lords providing like just peasant foot soldiers, basically cannon fodder, you might say. And in terms of more elite effective infantry, the French continued to rely on Swiss pikemen or German Landsknechts. Whoever they could hire.
Outsourcing.
Exactly. Which could be quite expensive and meant that...
And not that reliable as well.
It becomes hard to have prolonged wars as you need to constantly pay their wages. And, you know, if their wages don't get paid, they could easily be bribed away by the emperor or something. So militarily, Francis was an early achiever with the Great Battle of Marignano, winning him Milan in the first year of his reign, which we thought was pretty impressive, even though Venice did a lot of the work. But it's a bit of a roller coaster after that. So
he held out.
Yeah, so it's highs and lows for Francis. So on one hand, we have Marignano, but then we have the shocking defeat at Pavia and, like, the real incompetence of Francis's governors in Milan, which lose Milan and get Francis captured. But Francis did have some later diplomatic victories. The League of Cognac, which was the league he formed after getting freed from prison, was considered very duplicitous and really pissed off the empire, as he essentially just reneged on all of his promises. But it was effective, on guard-wise, selfish win-wise.
Yeah, it really was.
And these kind of diplomatic victories were a group effort between him and his advisors, most notably his mother, of course. Yes. And when Louise died, her protégé, Anne de Pisseleu, Francis's mistress, served this role of some kind of smoothing diplomatic relations. And the intervention of Pope Pius III helped with this diplomacy as well. We also have Emperor Charles's failed attempt to actually invade Provence, which Francis's general, Anne de Montmorency, manages to defeat, mainly because all the imperial troops die of dysentery and poison fruit, if you remember that. So then, of course, then we got a new category in En Garde, which is just being introduced.
Ooh.
Exploration.
Ooh.
Slash horrific colonialism. So under Francis I, well, it still counts as a selfish win. So under Francis I, we finally see the French start to take proper interest in the New World. So Spain had already started colonizing the Caribbean. You know, America's been discovered for like 20 years at this point. And in 1521, Hernan Cortes rather horrifically managed to conquer the Aztec civilization in Mexico. A conquest which made Spain fabulously wealthy, but would end up causing massive inflation and severely devaluing the gold and silver that was flooding into Europe.
But introducing delicious chocolateness.
Well, yes, chocolate, most of the vegetables we use today, that's all getting introduced right now.
Like potatoes.
Potatoes, exactly. So oblivious to the devastation that the introduction of European weapons and diseases will have
on
the native populations of the Americas, Francis naturally also wanted his piece of the pie. So
of course,
in 1524, so shortly after the conquest of the Aztecs, he helped fund an expedition led by a Florentine named Giovanni da Verrazzano, who founded a colony in North America called New Angoulême. New Angoulême was later taken over by Dutch traders, who renamed it New Amsterdam, before the English then conquered it and renamed it New York. But the first Europeans to land in New York were French. Bet you didn't know that.
Like, I knew about it was called New Amsterdam at one point, but I didn't know
But it was originally named New Angoulême after Francis, So while colonialism was obviously awful and a devastating thing, and Francis was definitely complicit in it, these early French expeditions were more interested in setting up trade than, you know, carving out empires. So the most successful and lasting of these was founded in 1534 by Jacques Cartier in what is now Quebec.
Ah.
So the French had hoped to find a northern passage through Canada to Asia, but sort of ice gets in the way. So failing this, they began the North American fur trade with the local natives, which was a much needed boost for the flagging French economy. And beaver felt hats became all the rage.
Yeah, I was about to say beaver.
In France, towards the end of Francis's reign. Everyone wants a beaver hat, and this really helps boost the French economy.
I heard beaver glands smell like vanilla.
Ew. I didn't need to know that. Eliza, I really like vanilla. Now I'm going to think about that every time I have something vanilla flavored. It's disgusting. Okay. I'll never forgive
you. I've just ruined,
So the establishment of Francis...
I don't know if it's true, by the way.
I'm moving on, Eliza, I'm moving on. So the establishment of Francis' first American colonies, whatever your moral stance, I think it's a big selfish win for Francis.
Yeah, he gets beaver hats.
What do we want to give for En Garde? as I've said, it is a roller coaster.
It really is. There's ups and downs, ups and downs, ups and downs.
Like, on the one hand, you've got one of France's greatest victories, and then you've also got Pavia, one of his greatest
defeats. Almost, like, balances it out. It's like, if he didn't have that capture, it would be like, oh, you're really, really high up. But, yeah. Like, yeah, you gained it all, then you lost it. But then you kind of
Francis
it
does
out.
Manage to very much weasel his way out of.
Oh, yeah.
In a big
way. Oh, my
way.
God, so yes.
I think in terms of, like, agency, in terms of, like, just the pure selfish connivingness of some of the moves.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Just the sheer audacity as well.
I know.
I think it's going to be high marks.
Oh, yeah. He'll lose a couple points from getting captured because I'm like... But overall, I think it's, like, pretty good.
We didn't really talk about England here. There are a couple of English invasions that happen, although France is able to pretty much buy them all. But the way that Francis is, like, supporting, like, Anne Boleyn and, like, just kind of, like, stirring the pot and, like, keeping England and the empire from
turmoil,
from allying, it is, yeah, he's he did well in that regard.
Oh, that was smart. Because he knew that Charles would never forgive Henry for, like, divorcing his aunt.
He played the game. And he didn't let the religious factor kind of get in the way too much, which we've seen other kings definitely do.
Yeah. What are you thinking? Thinking maybe like an 8.
Yeah, I think Francis is big on the selfish wins.
Oh, yeah, his life is
but
selfish.
Ultimately, he's not, like, a great king in this regard. Like, he's good, he's not great.
Yeah.
But I think I will.
I'm thinking maybe a 7, actually.
No, I think I will give him an 8.
I think, I don't know.
You're more than welcome to give him a 7.
I think I'd do 7, because as you said, he's good, not great. Because he did have some major losses. So.
Yeah.
I think just getting captured, really, we haven't had that in a while for a king, so it's a bit like, oh, that's a major point.
Yeah, I guess
he got captured, held prisoner.
Okay, I'll give him a 7.5.
I'm sticking a 7.
You want to give him a 7? Lovely. So that is a 14.5 for En Garde. So moving on to Voulez-vous.
Yes.
Voulez-vous.
And again, I have lots of stuff in this round.
Yay.
The main positive for Francis the First is his almost universal popularity.
Yeah. Well, like, even Spain was loving him.
Yeah, so with the exception of the emperor who couldn't stand him, Francis had a knack for endearing himself to anyone he could gain a personal meeting with, balancing his, you know, mystique as the King of France with a personal kind of disarming charm and relatability that made him very difficult to dislike. Though you'd be surprised to learn that he was actually an introvert.
Well, that can be common.
Yeah, so the Englishman Sir Thomas Cheney wrote, "If a man speak not to him first, he will not likely begin to speak to him. But when he is once entered, he is as good a man to speak to as I have ever saw." Which I heavily relate to this as someone who is, like, probably more on the introvert side. But, you know, when I'm with my friends, I become an extrovert, I guess.
I think I used to be very much introvert, especially in high school.
Yeah.
But now I'm very much an extrovert.
Yeah, no, I think that's very much me as well. So despite his extravagant lifestyle, Francis did not set himself above others in the way that we might expect. I've mentioned he and his friends had, like, similar
same
chambers
quarters
at the Chateau de Chambord. Yeah. Francis is also the first king to introduce a title called the Gentleman of the Chamber, which are just his bros that would, like, just spend all their time with him, basically. And this is a very coveted title, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
The king also enjoyed swapping clothes with his friends. He loved disguises and he loved practical jokes. As a young man, one of his favorite pastimes was going out incognito at night and egging people's houses.
Oh my God, he's like a child on Halloween.
Yeah. So Francis, he rejects a lot of the formal austerity of past reigns in favor of more fun, frivolous atmosphere at court.
Can't blame him.
And things could become extremely permissive, especially when late night drinking was involved. But it was possible to go too far.
Oh.
Francis allowed his beloved jester, Triboulet, to entertain the court by essentially roasting him and his friends. So he would stand up in front of the court and basically insult everyone there. But one evening, Triboulet went too far by spanking the royal derriere.
Woo!
During one particularly raucous evening, Francis flew into a rage, saying he'd have Triboulet's head. But the king's rage didn't last very long, and Triboulet endeared himself again by saying, quote, "I'm sorry, Your Majesty, but I didn't recognize you. I mistook you for the queen." And Francis thought this was so cheeky and funny that he forgave the jester. So you can see Francis is like, you know, if this was Henry VIII,
oh yeah,
that jester would not be alive
anymore. Oh yeah, he'd be dead.
Whereas Francis is like, he kind of takes things in a stride. He's very easygoing. He's slow to anger. Mm. And when he does anger, you know, he's not angry for very long.
Yeah. He'll forgive.
And with the exception of maybe his imprisonment, in which he's rather, for obvious reasons, rather depressed, he generally had a very cheerful
outlook on life.
I mean, right up to his death, when he's very, very ill, he's still like frolicking with his ladies somehow. Like, if you remember when Henry VIII died, he sort of pretended to act sad for like 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah. And then he was like, ha ha ha.
Yeah, exactly. So some of the Francis's policies, getting more back into the political end of things. We've talked about Francis's cultural patronage a bit in MGK, including his sponsorship of Leonardo da Vinci, who was just one of many great artists and intellectuals who found a home at the French court. A later example is the writer François Rabelais, whom many consider to be the first French novelist, infusing stories of comedy and whimsy with philosophical and religious questions. And he was actually a Protestant, but Francis' sister Marguerite was like a big protector of Protestants and, you know, ensured that Rabelais continued to be treated well.
Like, he's good what he does. Doesn't matter about his religion.
Exactly. And this went for a lot of artists and writers and architects who flourished during Francis' reign. Often, no matter what your religious beliefs were at Francis's court, if you were skilled and, you know, did your job well,
could be forgiven.
And did not insult the royal person, at least not too much.
The royal we?
Yeah, you could get pretty far. Unfortunately, the extravagance of the French court, as well as the costs of all the wars, treaties, and huge ransoms, it took its toll on the finances of France, obviously. It didn't help that France, which had been experiencing both a population boom and an economic boom since the end of the Hundred Years' War, started coming down off this high sometime in the first decade of his reign. So we start to see a recession happening. The causes of this recession are, of course, a bit more complicated than just, you know, Francis spent all the money.
Francis is good times.
there are some more complicated causes than that. Although, you know, we can partially credit his excessive spending with this. He also debased the coinage at least twice during his reign, which is never good. It's good in the short term. It's bad in the long term. And by the end of his reign, there was plenty of nostalgia for the prosperous reign of Louis XII that had come before, where things were a bit more stable. The rapidly growing cities of France were becoming overpopulated slums. French trade suffered due to wars with its neighbors. And there was an increase in provincial unrest. And rebellions and harsh punishments increased as many of France's subjects broke away from the Catholic faith that Francis held so dear. And that brings us to the Protestants. Going into less fun territory, we have to talk about Francis' relationship with the emerging Protestant Reformation, which is the most important issue of his time and would have been perceived as such by people at the time, since, you know, it's about the fate of your immortal soul. The majority of French people remained Catholic and remain so to this day, but a vocal and rapidly growing minority believed that the Catholic Church was jeopardizing their immortal souls through corruption and through superstitious sacraments that weren't supported by the Bible. At first, in the 1520s, Francis was tolerant, if not supportive, of Protestantism, which initially seemed more like an effort to reform the Catholic Church rather than, you know, doing away with the Catholic Church altogether. Yeah. He also liked that the Protestants in Germany were such a pain in the neck for the emperor.
He was like,
and he actually gave some of them support and money to continue causing trouble. Moreover, as we mentioned, Francis' sister Marguerite, while she wasn't an out-and-out Protestant, she was pro-reform, and she kept up a scholarly relationship with lots of Protestants. But Francis' mother, Louise, was a traditionalist who was very disturbed at the reform movement. And Francis kind of oscillates between these two women in his life, pushing and pulling him. But he did suddenly change his tune in the 1530s, interestingly, just after Louise dies.
Mm.
And he started to believe that this movement could potentially be dangerous to his authority, perhaps even his personal safety.
Yeah.
Now, originally, when I wrote these notes, I tried to boil down, you know, why the Reformation happened and like what these Protestants believed and like how that was different from what Catholics believed and like how French Protestantism is different from German Protestantism. And oh my God, it's so easy to get into the weeds with this one. But I've got to draw a line somewhere.
Yes.
Otherwise, this episode will be 3 hours long. So the only concept that's relevant to this episode of Battle Royale is that Catholics love taking a picture of mid-quality wine and a bowl of bland wafers that taste like paper and transforming them magically into the blood and body of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, because Jesus does that in the Bible, apparently. But Protestants are like, no, that was just a metaphor. You can't actually turn bread and booze into a corpse. That's crazy. And also,
we're not cannibals.
And also, it's like sinful idolatry. You're worshipping meaningless objects, which the Bible says is bad. So this dispute, like, you know, Catholics upholding the Mass, the Eucharist, and Protestants rejecting the Mass leads to a famous incident one October night in 1534, when a collection of placards or posters was discovered on the door of King Francis's bedchamber in the Louvre, which criticized the, quote, horrific, great, and unbearable abuses of the papal Mass, invented directly contrary to the Holy Supper of our Lord, sole mediator and sole savior, Jesus Christ. So this here was a condemnation of the Mass, of the Eucharist, on the door of the king's most intimate quarters.
Yeah.
And this incident is known as the Affaire des Placards.
Wonder
the,
who did
the
it.
Affair of the posters. We don't know who did it to this day. And we don't know if this was like well-intentioned, you know, merely wishing to inform the king of the evils of Mass. But it was certainly not interpreted that way as Francis. Yeah. He saw it as a direct threat to his safety. And he was
like, they
shaken.
Can get all the way here.
Exactly.
To my door. It could easily kill me.
And this is also one of the rare rages that Francis flew into.
Okay, I do understand that if he had to go to, if I was like him and had to go to Mass every week and you're getting hungry, that little tiny piece of paper bread can tide you over till lunchtime. So that was me in high school. So I do understand that, wanting to keep the bread.
So yeah, Francis, usually he had a very approachable demeanor.
Yeah.
He'd become rather lax with his palace security. and he, you know, he wasn't usually a paranoid king, but this Protestant threat, or what he perceived as a threat, had really struck a chord. So Francis immediately ordered the celebration of a public Mass to show those Protestants who was boss, which included a procession of various relics like the crown of thorns through the streets. Another thing Protestants hate, relics as well. So the message was loud and clear. Francis was and always would be a Catholic, and he expected his kingdom to fall in line.
He just liked his little bread too much.
Because, by the way, meanwhile, Paris was simultaneously subjected to a literal witch hunt.
Ooh.
So all manner of suspects were being arrested, many being burned at the stake. Restrictions and eventually bans were imposed on printing houses. And a number of Protestant preachers and theologians fled Paris, including one Jean Calvin, known to us as John Calvin. So like many of Francis' enemies, John Calvin was Swiss. although rather than a pike, he wielded the pen. And he was originally a lawyer, and his special interest was theology, though he had suspiciously refused to join the church. So he was a hugely prolific writer. He translated the Bible into French, which was a big no-no. And he wrote tomes and tomes of commentary on the Bible, as well as polemics and apologia and other aggressively important documents that would form the basis of a subsection of Protestantism, which we now call Calvinism. Which is different to Lutheranism in various ways that we don't have time for. In 1540, Francis instituted the Edict of Fontainebleau, which severely curtailed the civil rights of Protestants who, by practicing heresy, were committing treason against the king, and so deserved to have their property taken away, be publicly humiliated, or even executed. And as you can imagine, this had a devastating effect on non-Catholic communities throughout France. Well, there was one religious minority called the Waldensians in the far south of France, who had existed in small kind of hermit-like communities long before the Reformation. They ended up suffering a massacre as a result of these restrictions in 1545, called the Massacre at Merindol. This killed 3,000 people and wiped out over 20 villages.
Whoa.
And this massacre was just a hint of the devastation that will come with the outbreak of the French French Wars of Religion, which will occur within 15 years of France's death. So he very much presages some of that that carnage which we're going to see not too far off. So that's Voulez-Vous. Once again, very much a mixed bag.
Yeah.
It's sort of very good at the beginning of the reign, but then by the end of the reign, the cracks are really starting to show.
Yeah.
So what do we want to give for Voulez-Vous?
Like, if I was Catholic, sure, I'd live under him. It'd be okay.
Mm.
But if I had differing views...
But also, like, this isn't like Christianity and Judaism, where they're very much like separate communities.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you're... brother might be a Protestant, and then you know, he's getting dragged off and executed, and like
that'd be,
even if you are Catholic, you might not agree with that kind of repression. Or it's very complicated. It's very much a brother turned against brother kind of situation in France. It's obviously not at its worst, and Francis is quite lenient for the majority of his reign. It's really not until the end of his reign that he starts clamping down. But yeah, it's, especially with all of the financial stuff, it's difficult to see his reign as a net positive for France, in a way.
True.
Culturally, amazing. Monetarily.
Yeah, not so great.
Definitely worse than Louis XII, who got an 8.
Maybe a 5 or 6.
We did give Louise of Savoy a 5. I think
I'd go 5.
Francis in a similar ballpark, yeah.
Yeah, I think I'd do 5.
I think this may have to be his worst round. But that is still a 10. So
true.
It's not too bad. 10 out of 20 there for Voulez-Vous. So that's Voulez-Vous. Moving on to Ooh La La.
Yes. Ooh La La.
So let's get into the womanizing, the sauciness. which is the main... I've now realized it's really the only heading I have in Ooh La La. we do have like kind of his like duplicity, his kind of like going against treaties, that kind of thing. That's considered very scandalous at the time. His dealings with the Ottomans as well, that's considered very scandalous. But it's really his, the fact that he got around is really the big thing that stands out in his reign. So we've covered a couple of the myths surrounding Francis' sex life. For example, supposedly he had an affair at the age of 10 with his father's mistress, and supposedly he had an incestuous relationship with Marguerite. But these myths emerged from the real truth that Francis had a voracious sexual appetite. So he had 2 long-term mistresses, whom we are currently covering in the boudoir on the Patreon. So Francoise de Foix and Anne de Pisler de Ye, and they gained unprecedented influence as the official royal mistresses. So the dark-haired, sensitive poet Francoise was relatively inoffensive, but the outgoing blonde Anne, whilst she submitted to the king's every whim, she was politically ruthless, and she plotted with Marguerite, actually, to oust Francis's main advisor, the constable de Montmorency, which we will get to in Anne's episode, and we'll talk a bit more about in Henry II's episode, because it has some knock-on effects.
Ooh.
So we'll be getting more into that on Patreon. But outside of these 2 publicly acknowledged mistresses, Francis was known or was rumoured to have slept with a number of other high-profile women, mostly ladies-in-waiting to his wives or minor noble women he met on his travels, including, supposedly, Mary Boleyn, the sister of Anne Boleyn, who also slept with Henry VIII. So.
Oh, the scandal of allowing that little secret marriage between Anne and Henry. That'd be scandalous.
Well, their secret marriage happened when they got back to England.
Yeah, but he was like,
But it is rumoured that they slept together while they're in France, possibly at the encouragement of King Francis. as portrayed in the hit show, The Tudors. So that's not even, you know, taking into account the countless courtesans and, quote, ladies of joy that hung around the court on a constant basis. There are even stories of Francis showing up to people's houses, like the houses of, like, bourgeois citizens, ordering the man of the house to sleep outside the bedroom and taking his place in the bed with his wife.
Oh.
That's just a liberty that Francis took occasionally when he wanted a night out. And as you can imagine, you know, it is hard to say no to the king. And this could have some tragic, unforeseen consequences, and as it did in a few cases. During one of his progresses early in his reign, a beautiful maiden who felt unable to reject the king's advances decided to disfigure herself by burning her face with a hot dish in order to avoid the king's advances. Because, like, she literally couldn't say no.
Oh my god.
Then there's the husband of one of his lovers, La Belle Ferronnière. Mm-hmm. He is said to have purposely contracted syphilis so that he could give it to his wife, so that she could give it to the king.
Oh!
Yeah. Which is kind of hoisting yourself with your own petard, I reckon. Francis is also have rumoured to have slept with a very distinguished lady of the court called Diane de Poitiers, who is the future mistress of his son, Henry II. And this is another one we don't know what happened for sure, but unfortunately most accounts of the story have Francis forcing himself on her. So that's not brilliant. So yeah, Francis is, yes, by 21st century standards, not an upstanding gentleman.
Yeah, he's a creep.
But Francis always had the appearance of chivalry, and he was very into, like, the Arthurian kind of courtliness.
Yeah.
And it's perhaps because of this this outward display of chivalry and honor that Francis's first wife, Claude, showed very little signs of jealousy or distress at his lifestyle. She's sort of just like, oh, well, boys will be boys. And the marriage was successful in the sense that there was little to no drama between them. And once again, they had seven kids. Francis was very strategic about the time he would spend with Claude. And he made sure that whenever she wasn't pregnant, they were constantly sleeping together.
I felt as though, like, he would be someone who, like, kept track of the cycles and been like,
oh, yeah, okay, he's got a chart.
Okay, she's fertile now. Let's go.
He's got a big spreadsheet of not, like, and where there's, like, one sheet is Claude's chart. And the second sheet is all of the other mistresses that he has to arrange.
To make sure he doesn't, like, impregnate them.
And keeping track of which ones' husbands have syphilis so that he doesn't get it.
Oh, yeah.
Interestingly, King Francis never publicly acknowledged any illegitimate children.
Ooh, see, it's the charts.
I mean, I'm pretty sure half the population of France currently is probably descended from Francis. But there were a number of young nobles running around the court who were rumoured to have been sired by the king. Maybe they had suspiciously large noses.
Maybe. Or very thin legs.
Or very, very spindly legs and very big shoulders.
Yeah.
Lots of Johnny Bravos running around. So that is Francis's main scandal. What do we want to give him for Ooh La La?
I'm thinking, like, a 5.
Interesting. I thought it would be way higher.
I know, but I'm like, I don't have any of, like, the poison, or murder. I can imagine him probably sometimes slept, if he was mad with one of his, like, courtiers, he probably slept with their wife. Just, he was like, I'm pissed at you, I'm going to sleep with your wife.
But the, I mean, to me, the womanizing is, like, so far above and beyond anything we've ever seen.
True. A few points for the imprisonment, because we haven't had that in a while.
No, I'm thinking more like something like an 8.5. Like, I think.
Wow, you're thinking so high, and I'm like,
I think it's very high.
Okay, maybe like a 6.
Being real harsh.
I know, I'm usually so generous in this section, but I'm like, women, yeah, that's pretty, like, you know, but I'm like, I need some more.
I'm going to do an 8.
Okay.
And you can do a 6, yeah. So
that's rare.
That's a 14. It's really not rare looking at the scores. I'm always consistently more generous in Ooh La La.
No,
yeah.
Really? I was still like, I usually am. Then again, I do like it more evil.
No, I'm looking at the scores now, and I've given loads more points in Ulala than you have.
Wow. I guess I'm just like the more evilness.
That's a 14 for Ulala. Now moving on to Lovey on Throne.
Lovey on Throne.
So Francis reigned from the death of his cousin Louis the 12th on the 1st of January 1515 until his own death on the 31st of March 1547, which is an admirable length of 32 years, 2 months and 30 days.
Wow.
Which gives him 6.02 points for the on throne. And now it's time to get into the children. So I haven't gone into them too much in these episodes, except where they're like essential, but we'll get into them individually now. So with his first wife, Claude of France, Duchess of Brittany, it took them about a year after their marriage to have their first child in 1515. But then, as we've said, in the next 8 years, they had 7 Pumped children until her tragically early death in 1523. So we've got two daughters, first off.
Yep.
We've got Louise and Charlotte. And Louise was betrothed to Emperor Charles V, but then she sadly died at age 3. And then Charlotte was also betrothed to Charles, but she died at age 7. So, it's very sad. Then we get the first son. We've got Francis Jr., Francois.
Oh, yeah.
He was both the Dauphin and the Duke of Brittany, which he reigned as Duke Francis III. And in August 1536, at the age of 18, sadly, the Dauphin Francis suddenly died, probably of some kind of illness like tuberculosis, although it was widely suspected that he was poisoned with a cup of water after a round of tennis. Exactly the way that Louis the 10th supposedly died. So I'm already raising an eyebrow at this one.
Yeah, I'm like, why are they hating on him? He's a prince. He hasn't done anything.
No, but the fact that it's the exact method that a previous thing is rumored to have
died
of, it's like, it makes me raise eyebrows. So Francis's Italian secretary, Count Sebastiano de Montecuccoli, was imprisoned in Lyon, near where the Dauphin had been staying, and was accused of having poisoned his young employer. Italians were often associated with poison and skullduggery at the French court, and it was widely suspected that Catherine de' Medici had put Sebastiano up to it, because if Francis was dead, then that meant Catherine de' Medici, who by this point is married to his brother Henry, gets to be the Queen of France. So you can see how a court that is already very suspicious of Italians in general would come to this conclusion. But, you know, seeing as Catherine is like 15 at this stage, and she's brand new to court, I highly doubt she would have been able to orchestrate this plot, even if she wanted to. And there was no evidence to back up the claim of poisoning. But Sebastiano was, surprise, surprise, tortured into confessing. Though he said it was the emperor and not Catherine who put him up to it. So Catherine's in the clear. And on the king's orders, he was publicly dismembered in Lyon 2 months after the Dauphin's death. Even though an autopsy did show that the Dauphin was suffering from tuberculosis when he died.
Yeah.
So that's a bit unfortunate. But then we get to the son that did succeed Francis, and that's Henry II, who was actually named after Henry VIII, who was his godfather. Yeah.
Oh.
He is most famous nowadays for being the husband of Catherine de' Medici, but we'll see how he stands on his own 2 feet next episode.
It's kind of funny that he's named after Henry VIII, who's remembered because of all of his wives.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the 16th century is really like the women's century almost.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, we'll see how Henry does next episode. So,
yeah.
While King Francis had gotten along quite well with Dauphin Francis, the same can't be said for the new Dauphin, Henry, who was far more outspoken, boisterous, and proud than his more subdued brother had been. Henry also despised Catherine, his wife, and ignored her in favor of his mistress, Diane de Poitiers. More on that love triangle next episode. But Francis seemed to have shown fatherly affection towards Catherine, and he refused to let Henry back out of the marriage.
Good.
And we saw that Catherine was one of the main people at Francis' deathbed, who was like looking after him.
Yeah, she cried.
He was old, yeah. So then we get to the fifth child. We've got Madeleine, who became the Queen of Scots.
Ah, yep, yep, yep.
So the same month that Sebastiano, the Dauphin's rumoured killer, was executed, King James V of Scotland, the nephew of Henry VIII and the future father of Mary, Queen of Scots, arrived at the French court, and he'd been trying for years to solidify the old alliance by marrying France's daughter, Madeleine. He decided to come all the way to France to kind of pester the king into finally letting him marry his daughter. And Francis did finally give in.
I can just imagine him like poking at the king's shoulder and being like, come on, let me marry her. He's like, fine.
Although Francis thought his 16-year-old daughter was a bit too frail and sickly for the windy glens of Scotland. But nonetheless, the couple were married the following January at the Cathedral of Notre Dame. And then after months of preparation, Madeleine set sail for Scotland in May 1537.
Mm.
But 7 weeks later, her health failed and she died in Holyrood Palace. And the Scots dubbed her, quote, the Summer Queen.
Yeah.
So her husband ended up remarried to another French woman, the far more robust Marie de Guise, who in 1542 became the mother and regent of Mary, Queen of Scots, after James V also died an untimely death. But we will certainly get to that in the future episode, as Mary, Queen of Scots will come into the picture.
Yes.
Now, the sixth child, we've got Charles, initially the Duke of Angoulême, but then promoted to the Duke of Orleans after the Dauphin's death. He was Francis's favourite. He was an extremely popular boy who enjoyed practical jokes. Initially, he was in talks to marry Princess Elizabeth of England, the future Elizabeth I. But the fact that her mother, Anne Boleyn, was Protestant and not legally married to the king in the eyes of the Catholic Church meant that this was never really going to happen. Yeah. And this was pretty much confirmed when Anne Boleyn was executed in 1536. Then one of the later truces between Francis and Emperor Charles, the Treaty of Crepy, meant that Charles was given the choice of marrying either Charles's daughter, Charles of Angoulême was given the choice of marrying either Emperor Charles's daughter, Maria, who would bring Franche-Comté, east of Burgundy, as her dowry, or he could marry Emperor Charles's niece, Anna of Austria, who would bring Milan as her dowry. Now, older brother Henry was extremely jealous of Charles, both because he was Francis's favourite and because he was getting a way better marriage deal than he was.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, though, Charles of Angoulême was still deciding when he died in 1545, either of influenza or the pneumonic plague. And Charles's death nullified the treaty, and the Italian Wars continued as a result of his death. So that is Charles of Angoulême, the favourite child. Then the youngest child of Francis was named Marguerite after his sister.
Yeah.
She remained unmarried until the age of 36.
Oh.
And she was given a generous estate as the Duchess of Berry.
Nice.
But she eventually did get married to Duke Emmanuel Philibert of Savoy, who, is her cousin. And she had one son with him.
Oh, wow, she actually had a child.
Yeah, so her wedding was shocking and tragic for very different reasons to her sister Madeleine's. But I will leave that story unspoiled for a future episode. Just know that something horrifying and calamitous happens at Marguerite's wedding. But yeah, I'll leave it on a cliffhanger there. So then Francis has no children by his second wife, Eleanor of Austria. Yeah.
He had two surviving children.
Yeah, one surviving son, one surviving daughter, Henry and Marguerite.
He lost all the ones he liked.
Yeah, sad. Although he did like Marguerite. He liked pretty much all of them except for Henry.
That's a very common theme.
And that gives him a score of 3.38 points towards his children. So combining the reign and the children, that's a 9.4 out of 20 for the on throne, which is not too shabby. So now let's come to the final score.
Yes, grand total.
The grand total score is 67.9.
Okay.
So he's not quite in the 70s club. I'm not sure if he scraped the top 10. I think he scraped the top 10, but just barely.
For now.
But I think overall, I kind of expected Francis to get a higher score. But
yeah.
It's just such a complicated reign.
Yeah, so many ups and downs.
But at least he did get full marks in Enchanté. At least he is
true.
Undisputedly very fabulous.
True.
But of course, the final score does not matter at all when it comes to determining, is he fascinating enough, entertaining enough, majestic and fabulous and irresistible enough to be released from our dungeon, to go through to the Battle Royale tournament, and to be spared the guillotine.
I want to spare him. I want to let him live.
Yeah, this one's pretty much a no-brainer for me. I think we should spare him because he is so iconic.
Yeah, he's interesting.
You know, for all the flaws of his reign, he's definitely interesting. And what he sometimes lacks in success, he makes up for in bluster, I think. And he's definitely, I think, the most relatable king we've had so far.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you can definitely see him as a rounded person.
Like, I could see him like being like, oh, I'd want to hang out with him. He seems fun.
Except for his lack of...
scandalous.
Well, his lack of boundaries when it comes to consent.
Yeah.
But apart from that...
Yeah.
That is him spared.
Yeah.
Francis's reign, obviously, very action-packed, very eventful. We get such a burst of detail in this period. So there's a lot of stuff that I will have missed out, obviously. But if there is anything interesting that you want to add about Francis, please let us know on social media or on our WordPress.
Yeah, it was like a little fun fact.
After this episode, Eliza and I are both going on holiday for the next month.
Yes.
So there will be no new episodes in May, at least not in the free feed. But yeah, just know we're not going anywhere. We're just having a well-earned
break. Both visiting family.
Although I will be doing lots of research in my time off so we can very thoroughly cover the era of Catherine de Medici, which we're getting into.
I'll just be melting in the heat of Thailand.
As Eliza will just be humid.
Yeah, it's like 40 degrees there.
And I will have a 20-hour plane ride between Scotland and Australia, so that'll give me plenty of time for the audiobooks and ebooks that I've got loaded up about Catherine de Medici and her era. So our next episode on Henry II, will hopefully be coming out at the start of June. So this summer and pretty much all the way up until Halloween, we'll be covering that whole Catherine de Medici era.
Nice.
Because there's quite a few kings that France
got
during that time. And this will include the French Wars of Religion and the end of the House of Valois. Dun, dun, dun.
Ooh.
So I'm excited, but also scared. And in the meantime, you guys can still listen to new episodes of Battle Royale if you choose to join our Patreon. So
if you haven't already.
So we'll be releasing some new episodes there. And you also get, you know, the 2 years worth of old episodes as well.
Mm.
We've already released France's first mistress, Françoise de Foix. And his second mistress, Anne de Pisler, will be out the week after this episode, or a couple weeks after this episode. So those will be available if you sign up to our boudoir tier on Patreon. But in addition to that, in our upper tiers on Patreon, we're also going to do like mini episodes on Leonardo da Vinci's final years in France, and another on the colorful character of King Francis's sister Marguerite. So stay tuned for those episodes as well. Any parting words, Eliza? Any advice for the listeners?
Be careful when playing tennis. Be careful on horses. Don't fall off them. Don't start wars with the Italians.
Use protection.
Yep, use protection.
If you're sleeping with every lady at the court. So you don't die of gonorrhea.
Syphilis.
Or syphilis. We don't really know, do we? And that's going to be au revoir from me.
Goodbye from me.